night on the Patty Vasquez Show with Andrea Darlis to speak on the historic and rich life of George H.W. Bush. We have Andy Field from ABC News, as well as journalist Julie Unruh. And from the popular movie Wild Honey, we have actress Stephanie Weir, Rusty Schwimmer, Francis Stokes, and Todd Stashwick. And to keep us healthy on Wellness Wednesday, we have Dr. Bal Nandra. But now, live from the Allstate Skyline Studio here in Chicago, we are broadcasting live.
WGN, the greatest city in the world. Thank you for being with us. A very moving and solemn day as we all probably watched most of the funeral, or at least some of it, of former President George H.W. Bush. We're going to hop right on with our friend Andy Field from ABC News, who was there. Andy, what a moving, wonderful tribute to the former president. What did you think?
Everything from Alan Simpson to Meacham the historian to George W. Bush, all these eulogies. I just basically talked about what an honest, decent man George H.W. Bush was. And he certainly was when I covered him in the White House, at least to reporters and my interactions with him. But, the messages that everything was sent there today, it was interesting. It was almost like hopping in a time machine and seeing all these faces from 30 years ago and thinking, wow, it was such a different time than it is today.
Absolutely. And I know George W. Bush's eulogy is getting the most pub, as it should, because it was his father. And it was just, boy, I mean, I was in the car with the tears streaming down, especially toward the end. But I really thought he did a nice job in kind of capsulizing everything that the former president had done, from being a war hero all the way on up to jumping out of a plane for his 90th birthday.
Yeah, I heard Arnold Schwarzenegger, the movie star, weightlifter, governor, talk about the time that he had befriended George and Barbara Bush, and they invited him to Camp David, and said that, now remember, this is a guy who's full of energy, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
He said that George H.W. exhausted him playing horseshoes and golf and running and sledding. He said, at the end of the day, he says, I was out of gas, and this guy was ready for more. So he had a lot of energy, even at the time. I think he was maybe in his 60s then.
I think W said, Andy, that he moved in two speeds, full throttle, and then when he went to sleep.
That was it.
And then resting,
he really wasn't like that. He one part of his speech was, he asked his dad, why do you like to play speed golf? He goes, I got a lot of other things to do in the day. I want to get through this.
Right. Yeah, he wanted to, right, every day he wanted to enjoy. And that's the thing, I think, especially now for the younger generation or people who didn't know George H.W. Bush, they're learning a lot about him. I know there was that Newsweek cover that referred to him as being soft or wimpy, but he was anything but that. And everybody just, the word I heard over and over again, Andy, was just humble and just a kind person, a kind human being.
He was. And this is a story that I've told a few people since this happened. I was very fortunate to be the pool reporter at the White House the day his son, the Sunday his son became president. And they were going to drive to a church in Southeast Washington, a Baptist church. So it was, I was out there with the camera crew waiting for them to come out. We were going to try to throw some questions to him. Usually they don't answer. But before 7:30 in the morning, all of a sudden George H.W. Bush comes walking out of the White House, walks toward us, says, how you doing? And I said, great. You know, we ran up to him. We thought we were going to get an interview. And he waved us off. And he says, no. I don't want to. This isn't my day. This is my son's day. And, you know, happy to talk to you guys, but I don't want to be a TV star today.
Right.
Can you imagine another politician ever saying that?
No. It was funny because I know when W was president, George H.W. would call his son and say, can you believe that column? This is a story that George Bush W would tell. The elder would say, did you see that terrible column that they wrote about you or that editorial? And he would be more upset that they were criticizing his son than he ever was about himself.
Yeah, and that was part of the problem, that he probably didn't get elected to a second term, because he was more of a working man politician, that he knew what to get done. He was very good with international affairs, not quite as good at domestic, and that became part of his downfall when we hit a big recession and people blamed him, and he didn't seem to have the right words to react to it. But, yeah, he's a very self-effacing man. But the interesting thing was, he was sitting there talking to us, and as we were on the South Lawn of the White House waiting for his son to come out, finally Barbara Bush comes out and starts shooting daggers at him. And we were kind of imagining the word balloon over her head saying, "What are you talking to those people for?"
Right.
And he shook our hands and goes, "Well, got to go." And he hopped in the limo and stood up.
The enforcer, I think, is as yes. W referred to her today. We're talking to ABC's Andy Field, who has covered the former president for many, many years, and of course, the funeral today. Here's a little bit of George W. Bush today.
I once heard it said of man that the idea is to die young, as late as possible. At age 85, a favorite pastime of George H.W. Bush was firing up his boat, the Fidelity, and opening up the three 300-horsepower engines to fly, joyfully fly, across the Atlantic with the Secret Service boats straining to keep up. At age 90, George H.W. Bush parachuted out of an aircraft and landed on the grounds of St. Anne's by the Sea in Kennebunkport, Maine, the church where his mom was married and where he worshiped often. Mother liked to say he chose the location just in case the chute didn't open.
Isn't it? I know, and I'm sure. And it was such a beautifully moving speech, too, because you laughed. Of course, we saw the ending, everyone in tears, and when the casket was brought in, too. But just, did you get that feeling, Andy, that it was almost, I don't want to say a joyful eulogy, but just full of life, ironically?
Well, all of it was, and I think that's one of the things that's interesting is what a contrast it is to politics today. You know, we hear this mean-spirited talk, and it's not just from the White House. It's all across the spectrum these days. And it's a little disheartening to know that, wow, the motto that George H.W. Bush had and said often in his speeches, that he wanted a kinder, gentler nation, may have actually existed then, and he didn't know it, compared to what we have today.
I'm glad you brought that up. Bush biographer John Meacham gave a beautiful speech as well, saying that he governed with virtues that most closely resemble those of Washington and Adams, of T.R., of FDR, of Truman, and of Eisenhower, of men who believed in causes larger than themselves. It was like that at one point.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Alan Simpson said one of the nicest things in the entire thing, where he says, "Those who travel the high road of humility in Washington are not bothered by heavy traffic." And he said, certainly George H.W. Bush was one of those people.
Yeah, and there's something about death that brings people together. It, to me, was incredulous to see President Trump and President Obama and President Clinton and Secretary Clinton all in that first pew sitting together. There's something very royal and regal about that.
It was, and you know, it was also a little disconcerting in that President Trump barely acknowledged the other presidents,
yeah,
other than Barack Obama, who he had to say something to because he was sitting right next to him.
Right, right. It was very, very, that was very strange and awkward, you know, aside from a day that really was just filled with beautiful speeches and tributes. I also like, too, Andy, when George W. Bush brought up the brotherhood. Included in that was, as you mentioned, Schwarzenegger, Bill Clinton, that unlikely bond, and you know, the man who defeated him, that unlikely bond that they had over the years. What do you attribute that to?
I think a lot of it is having been in the office and understanding it. You know, certainly H.W. lost a second term to Bill Clinton, and not necessarily all of Bill Clinton's doing. Part of it was Ross Perot was running, too, and siphoned a lot of votes away. Most people think it was from Bush, not Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of bitterness in losing that, because he thought he was well qualified for the job and was doing a good job. But again, there wasn't that animosity in that campaign, that kind of hate-filled speech and calling people things like Crooked Hillary or Lion Ted and things of that nature. It just didn't exist back then. And it does now. And it's one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton looks stone-faced straight ahead when he walked in the room.
Absolutely. What will you most remember about the president and about today? What moved you most, Andy?
I think the last line George W. Bush said when he talked about him being the best father you could ever have, and he kind of broke down in tears. And you cannot be a human being who's had a parent who didn't, you know, choke up when you saw that, knowing and feeling that full emotion of a son, not just a president, not just a member of an iconic political family, but simply a son who is going to miss his dad.
Yeah. Absolutely. I saw a beautiful political cartoon the other day, and it's making the rounds. I'm sure you saw this as well, Andy. The plane had landed, and you can see George H.W. Bush getting off the plane in heaven, and he's in the clouds, and his daughter, who died at a very young age, I think she was 3, and then the former first lady were there greeting him, and his daughter says, "We waited for you."
Yeah. This was a tough year for the Bush family. They lost Barbara Bush to a pretty quick illness earlier in the year. And that was quite a funeral, one that Donald Trump was not invited to, pointedly not mm-hmm. invited to,
right.
At Barbara Bush's request, not anyone else. But it was George W. that was magnanimous and said, "Look, you're the president of the United States. We want you to be there."
Right. Absolutely. And I'm glad he did. Well, I appreciate your time, Andy. I know it's been a long day for you. And again, wonderful coverage of the funeral today. And we wish you the best.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. That's the great Andy Field from ABC News. And before we go into the break, we're going to leave you with the last part of George W. Bush's eulogy, where he is giving tribute to his dad. It's the last thing he said before he walked off the pulpit. And this is George W. Bush paying a final tribute to his father.
The President of the United States said this: "We cannot hope only to leave our children a bigger car, a bigger bank account. We must hope to give them a sense of what it means to be a loyal friend, a loving parent, a citizen who leaves his home, his neighborhood, and town better than he found it. What do we want the men and women who work with us to say when we are no longer there? That we were more driven to succeed than anyone around us. Or that we stopped to ask if a sick child had gotten better and stayed a moment there to trade a word of friendship. Well, Dad, we're going to remember you for exactly that and much more. And we're going to miss you. Your decency, sincerity, and kind soul will stay with us forever. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again."
Thanks again to ABC's Andy Field. After the news, we're going to talk with our friend at Channel 9, Julie Unruh, who's not only a phenomenal reporter, but she got the only interview with Michael Bush, who now lives in Chicago. Michael Bush, of course, worked for President H.W. Bush in the 1990s. I think it was 90 to 93. And he did talk to Julie about the man he called his personal hero. It's a wonderful, moving interview. So we're going to talk to Julie right after the news. But we wanted to play you a little bit more of George W. Bush's speeches today, or his eulogy, his tribute to his dad. Michael found this cut. This is one of my favorite parts of the speech. It speaks for itself. Why don't you just go ahead and roll this, Michael?
"He moved his young family from the comforts of the East Coast to Odessa, Texas. He and Mom adjusted to their arid surroundings quickly. He was a tolerant man. After all, he was kind and neighborly to the women with whom he, Mom, and I shared a bathroom in our small duplex. Even after he learned their profession, ladies of the night."
Isn't that fantastic? absolutely loved it. I laughed, I cried, and the words we heard over and over again today throughout all of the speeches at the former president's funeral: integrity, kindness, dignity, humor, empathy, loyalty, generosity, and truth. Truly great attributes. And his son said, when the history books are written, they will say that George W. Bush was a great president of the United States, a diplomat of unmatched skill, a commander-in-chief of formidable accomplishment, and a gentleman who executed the duties of his office with dignity and with honor. I, you know what? Can we get the president to give my eulogy? You think if that'll ever happen? God forbid. God forbid, as my mother would say. I think he just said it beautifully. I really did. So again, after the news, we're going to talk to Julie Unruh with her interview with Michael Bush, no relation, B-U-S-C-H. And then a little bit later on in the program, we're going to talk with the cast of Wild Honey, and we're going to talk to Dr. Bal Nundrum, who's our friend. We've had him on the Cochrane Show before. He's been on different programs throughout the station. It's Wellness Wednesday, and Dr. Bal Nundrum, if you have not heard him before, he's a great speaker. He's a wonderful doctor, and he provides ketamine treatments, which are really, really helpful with PTSD and headaches and all kinds of ailments. So basically, whatever ails you, Dr. Bal Nundrum is going to take care of it. 7:37 on 720 WGN. Thank you, David Jennings. It's the Patty Vasquez Show with me, Andrea Darlis. Patty has the night off. We've been talking about the life and public service of the nation's 41st president that were celebrated with praise and music and humor at Washington National Cathedral today. I know someone who was watching it very closely is our dear friend and one of the greatest reporters in Chicago, Julie Unruh from Channel 9. Hi, Julie.
Andrea, I've got to hang out with you more often. You are so good for me. My goodness, those are kind words.
Well, you are wonderful. I know you're doing double duty. I know you've been anchoring this afternoon, so thanks for taking time.
Of course. I would do it for George Bush. I would do it for you. These are just, it's such an incredible time. You know, I ended up working for George Bush as a very young girl, right out of college. And so to really, here we are 25 years later or whatever it is just amazing to sit and think back about an incredible life lived, to celebrate all that he embodied, that he often didn't get credit for, right? Isn't that how it always goes, you know, as we all look back? And it's just been a privilege, really, to be a part of this kind of coverage.
It absolutely has. And I said to Andy Field earlier from ABC News, it's so interesting to look back and having lived it, being younger, but now this generation is learning so much about H.W. Bush. It's sad that in death we have to learn about the former president's life, but it kind of seems like that's what we're doing.
Well, and part of it, you know, this is just my thought about it, too, is he was such a humble man in every way. And we really heard it in the funeral proceedings, the eulogies today, that it really wasn't until someone forced his hand and in politics to start talking about his heroic past as a pilot and the incident when he was shot down in the South Pacific. You know, he was called a hero back then, and even in his humble role as a modest man, he would simply say, gosh, how can you call someone like me a hero? I was shot down. What about the guys who are flying every day and aren't shot down?
Right.
And,
right.
You know, the reality is he didn't want to talk about this stuff. It wasn't his nature. His mother was really instrumental in trying to instill that in him, to be modest always.
And Julie, what was it like working for him at a younger age, being a young cub reporter?
It was great. I was not a reporter at the time. I was actually working in the White House for him in the administration.
Wow.
And for a girl at 22 right out of college, it's the best job I'll ever have. As I've said, don't tell the bosses here at WGN.
Yeah.
But it was the White House, which is something inside the Beltway people know, but outside the Beltway here in the Chicago area, people don't really know. It is a young man's game to work in the White House, whether you are serving the president, as I was in the press advance office. Michael Bush, who I interviewed, was in the press office. Someone serving even in the Secret Service. It's a young man's game because the hours are long, the weeks are long. And George H.W., you know, 41 was courteous. Now, he kept up a rigorous schedule. So don't kid yourself. I think we were listening to Tom Kasha on the set today here at WGN-TV. He, protecting the president, said it was tough to keep up with this guy. He had a competitive spirit, but he also had, you know, two speeds, which was full throttle or off.
Or off, yeah.
It, right?
Yeah.
Or asleep. And keeping up with him day to day was tough, but he was also really thoughtful, you know, would spend his Christmas Eves and Christmas Days at the White House so that all the staff members, all the press corps that would follow him at his every move, whether it was in D.C. or outside traveling in the United States or even, you know, in foreign travel. It required so many people, hundreds of people follow him when he makes a move around town. He was conscious of that. Not many are. And yes, it's everybody's job to follow his every move. But he would hang low on those days to try and give those folks a break on a holiday. Really thoughtful beyond words.
Absolutely. And Julie, what I found so interesting, too, is his commitment and dedication to family. And a lot of people say, oh, he's a family man, or she's really into her family. He really was. And he took when he lost the reelection, he went off into the sunset with his family. I know we focused on his foundation, but really family was just everything to him.
And how smart he was to have positioned himself, not just in politics, not just in life outside of his home, but even under his own roof, to know that family comes first. And when his time in politics or as an oil man or as a Navy pilot was over, what's important was still right before him. And when it came time for him to pull away from the spotlight and the public eye, he had everything he needed right under his own roof. And that's who he was. And I think that's what he's continued to instill in his own home among his five children that he ended up raising with his wife, the many grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all who continue to put family first, it would appear.
How did he treat the press, Julie? I mean, you were in the press office at a very young age. Was there a respect level there? And I'm asking for a multitude of reasons, obviously, but I'm just curious. And even the time period, too. The press and those, as you said, young reporters, young, going 24/7, really, to cover the president of the United States.
You know, it's an interesting question. We are in a different time now. So the way we see our current president treat the press is very different than what would have been the case in the late 80s, early 90s. It just wasn't the way George H.W. Bush did business. He was a gentleman first. He led with his head and his heart. But he knew what it meant to be a decent man, even to an archenemy, right? And it's not to say that the press should be the archenemy, but I do think that that is the tension that you feel today between our current president and the National Press Corps, the White House Press Corps. I think President Bush was always a gentleman, and as we heard Senator Simpson say, too, you know, Senator Simpson from Wyoming, the Republican from Wyoming, was on the receiving end of some tough press, right, when
right.
he was trying to survive in a Washington climate. And President Bush, 41, found ways to laugh about it, right? He knew it was part of his existence, and instead of pushing them away, I think he learned to work with the press, and they are literally under his roof at the White House at every, you know, Rose Garden ceremony, at every press conference, at every dinner. But the same kind of tension didn't exist back then than it does now. It doesn't mean that they were too cozy. It just means that it wasn't quite as difficult. There wasn't quite as much friction, even though there was a job to do. And they weren't always kind to President Bush. I think, you know, his defeat in 92 was certainly difficult. And I think, you know, having worked it myself during that election year, you felt like the work that the president was doing in the field at the time was not being portrayed on the front page of the papers the next day. And that was hard for a young kid like me to understand and to learn with time. But, you know, perception is perhaps everything sometimes.
And I'd love to get your reaction, too. When Bush lost to Clinton in 92, he really greeted that public defeat by showing humility and dignity and would go on to forge this crazy unexpected friendship with Bill Clinton. So what was that like? Again, being young in the White House, you go on to be a reporter and probably end up covering this unexpected friendship between the two men.
Well, let me just say this. I never could have predicted it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't think
right.
any of my colleagues could. I'm not sure his wife could have predicted it. I'm not sure Jim Baker could have predicted it. And I do think that what that really shows is what an incredible human being George H.W. Bush is. He was ousted from office in an office that he wanted to keep and retain. And when you turn over the keys to the big house, you know, it's a big lump to swallow, I think. And he handled it with such grace and such dignity, as you say. And then he found a way to navigate life within the bosom of his own family and went on to forge this, as I said, a very unexpected relationship with President Clinton in later years. And what a relationship it was, you know, Clinton really looking to him much like a father figure. And we're hearing that that's how Obama felt about him as well. So it really speaks to the kind of man, the kind of human being he was, that he was a mentor when he maybe didn't mean to be. He just had this kind of wisdom and welcoming spirit that people wanted to warm up to, no matter who they were.
We're talking to Julie Unruh from Channel 9. Julie, can you hold on just for 1 second? We have some breaking traffic, but I want to talk to you specifically about your interview with Michael Bush over the weekend, which was fantastic.
Sure.
750-720 WGN. We're talking to Julie Unruh from Channel 9 about her previous life, her previous career working for the former president whose funeral was today. And Michael Bush was the assistant press secretary. Julie, you got a rare, very rare, one-on-one interview with Michael Bush over the weekend. And I so enjoyed it because it was so personal. Tell us some of the stories that he shared with you.
You know, Andrea, I have to tell you, in the interest of full disclosure, it was really fun to talk to Michael, and it was a rare interview for the two of us to be sitting in a room together alone and the mic rolling.
Yeah.
Because Michael Bush, believe it or not, actually married my sister shortly after
he left. Did you make the introduction?
They met through the Reagan office. My sister worked for Ronald Reagan way back when in California, and Michael Bush was an intern there first. And they met at that office when he was finishing up at Pepperdine, but then ended up going across the country to go work for President Bush after he left the Reagan office, right out of college. So as I mentioned to you, this is a young man's game.
Yeah.
And Michael, it was fun to sit down with him. We usually have family members and Thanksgiving turkey in front of us when we're all chatting. And
right.
We don't get in 2 words. But Michael and I had a really good chat, and we're able to kind of stroll down memory lane together. Michael's contact with the president, really special. He had so much contact and interface with the president when the cameras were nearby, when they were wearing suits at the White House, and also in those private, more private moments when they were at Camp David, when they were at Walker's Point in Kennebunkport, Maine, together, because the job of an assistant press secretary, at least in Michael's particular role, was to travel with the president whenever he was leaving Washington, D.C. So if the president had a speaking engagement in town, Michael did not go. But he would switch off with another assistant press secretary. There were two of them, both males, young guys who would travel with the president, much like the military detail did, much like the doctors did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he spent Thanksgiving with the president 1 year up at Camp David, and along with all the other Bushes who had joined them up there, too. He, you know, watched them go sledding in the snow and having private family moments. And he said the president always made him feel like one of the Bush family members, even though his last name was Bush, spelled differently, no relation.
Right.
He said, "Michael, you're holding back with us. Let's let the mill aides and the doc go first through the food line right after they had said grace on Thanksgiving."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reality is Michael said he always felt like family when he was around the president.
I think that was so neat. That's why I really just enjoyed your interview. And it probably was rare for you, as you say, because you never get this one-on-one time. But when you were, he was literally dusting off the pictures and you guys were going from, you know, year to year. And I just thought it was so moving when he was telling you, Julie, that the president would invite them to Kennebunkport. And it's kind of like going home for the weekend with a college roommate, only, he happens to be the president of the United States.
It's true, except he happens to be the president. What's been fun for the Bush family is that Michael has continued on, serving the president in different ways. Whenever President Bush would come to town and maybe speak to a group at McCormick Place or something, they'd call Michael, who was local here, and say, "Hey, could you help us out? You know, the president's going to get off the plane. Could you meet him? You know, could you show him around or make sure he gets where he needs to go?" And Michael was always happy to do it. And he ended up doing that over the years. And then when the presidential library opened, Michael has been serving on the advisory board there as well. So he's continued a relationship not only with the president but with the family, and if you've been up to Kennebunkport in more recent years, I think the last time they were there was the summer of 2017. He and my sister both went up there, and, you know, the president was, you know, I don't want to say failing, but on the decline, right? I mean, then he was the age of, 93, so Mrs. Bush was still around, and things changed obviously dramatically in this last year, but it's always been a gift Michael Bush has felt to be so entrenched in their family, even as he's grown up. And all that, Michael's 51 now. He was working for the president when he was in his early 20s. And that's how it was for so many people. Serving a president, whether it is Bush or Clinton or W or Obama, mm-hmm. It is a young man's game. And they are eager to have young blood in there because they're long hours, long days. And again, it's the best work you'll ever find.
So I was going to end, Julie, and say, would you go back and do it? Would you change a thing? A young Julie Unruh, say 19, 20 years old, would you have changed a thing, or would you do it exactly the way you did it?
I think I would have loved to have seen a win in 92, and I, you know, my life would have been very different, right, if we would have stayed. But
sure,
it's not about me, and that's what history wrote. And I wouldn't change a thing. I would recommend to anybody who gets a chance to serve in politics, if that's what makes your heart beat, you know, working for someone that you admire so much, if politics is your game, and I would say any young kid, it is a form of service, too. And I think that if you look at it that way, there's a lot of good work out there, and it changes over just about every 4 to 8 years.
Did you stay in D.C. after that, or did you immediately then become a reporter and go to the different markets?
You know what? I came back to Chicago and bounced around and was really not happy in my work, because when you work in a job like that where it takes everything you've got, you know, the old adage is, do you live to work or do you work to live?
Right.
I really wanted to find a job that could sort of match that. And it wasn't really very easy. I just wasn't finding my niche. But in 1996, I ended up going out and working for CBS News, the network, who was beefing up their staff back then in a presidential year to do more of the same types of things. You know, the network would be covering the debates and the Republican convention and the Democratic convention, among other appearances that were related to an election year. So I was hired back with CBS then. I put my tape together, and that's when I had took it, got a job out in Topeka, Kansas, my very first television job as a reporter. A humbling experience, but a necessary one.
Yep.
And it eventually took me to Chicago, and I've been at WGN, for how about too long? Maybe close to 20 years now.
20, I thought, though, because I started here at radio in 97, and yeah. I think you were right around the same time, 98
yes,
or so.
Yes, I started at CLTV first.
That's yep. right.
Yep, you're right. You and I growing up together
That's
in
right.
Chicago.
Well, I love your reports, Julie. I mean, you did an awesome job this year with the Van Dyke trial and all your political reports, and I love watching and learning from you. So thank you always.
Oh, you're too kind. Happy to do it. Thanks so much for having me
thank
today.
Thank you so much, Julie. Are you anchoring tonight? Will we see you later on the news?
I will. Yes, we'll see you on the news at 9 o'clock. We'll have a full wrap of the funeral ceremonies today and the flight back to Houston, among other things in the news. So, yes, please watch 9 o'clock on Channel 9.
We will absolutely do that. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thanks, Andrea. Good night.
Good night. Julie Enra from Channel 9. Watch her in about an hour. She and Joe Donlan. More after this on 720 WGN. 807 720 WGN. Thank you, David. We'll keep you updated on that situation on I-57, where they're having some massive problems tonight. But we are in our warm studio here, high above Michigan and Wacker, at our new WGN studios in the Allstate Skyline studios tonight. So excited to have in studio the star of a movie. It's not a new movie. Wild Honey came out last year. However, there's a bunch of special screenings in Chicago and the surrounding suburbs starting this weekend and through next week as well. And if you haven't seen it, this is absolutely your chance. Rusty Schwimmer, our leading lady, is in studio with us. How are you?
I'm great. These are very fancy studios.
You like these?
Yeah.
Aren't they nice?
Yeah.
Got a good
nice
view. Navy Pier.
Right?
Got the river. Got the lake.
It's good stuff.
We got it all going on.
Yeah.
It's not often we have a big celebrity in our studios.
Oh.
So.
Oh, pshaw.
Oh, pshaw.
Yeah.
And your colleagues are all on the phone with us. We have Francis Stokes, Stephanie Weir, and Todd Stashwick. Francis is the writer-director. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Do you guys want to say hi to Rusty? She braved it and made it in studio.
Hi, you guys.
It sounds pretty cold there from the weather report.
Now, Francis, Stephanie, Todd, where are all you guys? Francis, we'll start with you.
I'm in L.A.
Oh, yeah, okay. What, 70 or 80 today?
It's been between, yeah.
You can just tell us. You don't have to laugh.
Let's be honest. It was rainy today in Los Angeles.
Oh, rainy and
that's
70.
Right.
I feel so bad. Todd, you too? Are you in L.A.?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and what about Stephanie?
I'm in L.A. as well, and it's a heavy sprinkle. Right.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Thanks for calling. Okay. Bye bye. No. Hey, you know what? Rusty
no,
and
really
I.
Cool. It was that gray sky that we don't get very often out here, but that I remember, you know, from Chicago.
Right.
Quite often.
You know, we tease you guys.
I have to scrape all that rain off my windows.
Yeah, right,
oh,
right.
Things,
yeah, we have to put on our rain boots here. No, it was balmy today. It got up to like 35.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it was balmy. We were dressed warm. But, you know, I joke, but Francis, Stephanie, Todd, Rusty's obviously in studio, but tell us all, you guys all have a Chicago connection here.
That's right.
Okay, let's start with, I know you guys are on the phone. Let's start with Francis, since you're the writer-director of Wild Honey.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Park Ridge.
Oh, I don't live too far from you. Pickwick?
Oh, yeah?
That's a good theater.
Isn't that a great theater?
Yeah.
We just did a really nice piece on our website, WGNradio.com, on the Pickwick, and I think it's like the 90th anniversary.
Oh, nice.
I used to go see movies there all the time, and of course, back when I was in high school, they were using it as the opening credits, or maybe when I was younger, for the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel show. Like, that was the theater they walked into.
Yeah, it was the thumbs up.
Old Art Deco
design. I had no idea.
Yeah, and the restaurant next door that's attached to it, I think it's still there. That's an awesome. That's great. It's like a little diner.
Yeah, it is.
That's a great place. Park Ridge is a great place to grow up. All right, how about Stephanie? Tell us your Chicago connection.
You know, I spent my formative 20s in Chicago and was on stage at Second City, and I thought that was my forever home, and I kind of got out to L.A. and have not made it back. But that's my tie. I can try it.
At least you spent your formidable 20s here, though. That's the most important thing. And how about you, Todd?
They say you learn everything.
I was born in the city proper, and then at 7 years old, I was whisked off to Hanover Park, Illinois. Shout out to Hanover Park, whoever might be listening. And I grew up there, and then Stephanie and I share lineage. We are both Second City alumnuses. So I was on stage in Second City as well.
Very nice. All right, and Rusty, let's tell us your Chicago. I know you're here, obviously, but us your roots.
I was born in Highland Park Hospital.
Okay.
And then I went really far from Highland Park to Winnetka, and then went really far from Winnetka to Glencoe.
North side.
Yeah. And I went to New Trier High School, and then I moved into the city as soon as I could.
So we kind of round out the city, the western suburbs. You're north. I grew up in the south suburbs as well, even though I'm not in the movie. I don't know. Maybe if there's a director's cut or a Wild Honey 2, I could play a reporter.
Oh, that'd be good.
I think you should do a Wild Honey 2. All right, well, tell us first of all about Wild Honey. I'm just going to read the first line. An offbeat romantic comedy about a lonely, down-on-her-luck phone sex operator who falls for one of her callers. And what does she do, Miss Rusty?
Oh, well, she's a pretty aimless human being, but very unapologetic for it. And she decides, she falls in love with one of her callers, and she decides that she's going to visit him in L.A., where also her sister Esther, played by the fantastic Stephanie Weir.
Yes.
She decides... And she decides to visit, and then hilarity ensues.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I love it. Stephanie?
Her estranged sister. Yeah.
Ah,
okay.
Estranged sister. Yes. Thank you, Francis. Thank you.
Okay. Now, Rusty and Francis, now, you've worked together in the past, right?
Yeah. Take this, Francis. Take it, dude.
Yes, that's right. It's been a while. We my first feature, which starred John Hawks, comedy about a wannabe daredevil stuntman, like a wannabe Evel Knievel. And Rusty was friends with John. They had done, I think they even knew each other prior, but they had done Perfect Storm, which was right around the time we were trying to get that movie together.
That's when we met.
That little old film, Perfect Storm.
Yeah, about a wave.
Yeah. That was, how she got involved with this. And then more recently, we did a short together a few years back, and that was what gave the idea that I wanted to see her helm a movie, you know?
I love it. And how'd she do?
Wonderful.
Oh, come on. Come on. We're talking about Wild Hunt. Now, the movie was officially out last year, but...
Not really. They said it was 2017.
They call it 2017.
Because it was at film festivals, but this is really...
This is the big debut.
I think so. What do you think, Francis?
It started the festival circuit about a year ago.
Okay.
And exactly. And then these screenings in Chicago would basically kind of be the theatrical debut because they're not connected to a festival. We're just playing a few dates there. And then it comes out on DVD and VOD on January 22nd, I believe it is.
Yep. Very cool. All right, so we're going to talk about how you could see the movie in Chicago and some of the suburbs. So hang on, L.A. folks. We're going to put you on hold for 1 second, okay?
Great.
Okay.
Okay. It's like the peanut gallery, isn't it?
Right.
God, it's much quieter without them, Rusty.
It is. Like, come on, man. No.
We're going to talk more about the film and how you are going to get a chance to see it. But first, let's take care of some business here on 720 WGN. 18 in the evening, 720 WGN, the Patty Baskett Show with me, Andrea Darlis. Patty is off tonight. We are so excited to have in studio the star of Wild Honey, Rusty Schwimmer, and our friends and her cast, her co-hosts from L.A., Stephanie Weir and Todd Stashwick, along with the writer-director Francis Stokes. And you guys are so funny. Rusty's showing me the press kit for Wild Honey, and you said, oh, well, it's officially out now, but we just went through this little thing called award season. There's two pages of all the awards that you guys have won, including You Best Actress at the Sunscreen Film Festival and the Newport Beach Film Festival Jury Award. Congratulations. Oops, sorry.
Oh, thank
there you.
You
go.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome.
The jury was Ashland, and Newport was another Best Actress, actually.
Holy cow. This is 12 awards. You guys got the official selection in Sedona, the Sunscreen Film Festival. What? Maybe I should say, what didn't you win?
It's always great to get that kind of recognition for a movie like ours. You really count on that kind of thing to get discovered.
And I love
Converse didn't win Best Costume.
Oh, there you go. All right, interview over.
That's right.
Yeah, kind of sad.
Rusty was telling me, we were talking about your cast and obviously your Chicago connections and how you guys all just, you know, can't stand working with each other. There's no camaraderie at all. None at all. No, quite the opposite. How you guys all just mesh so well. And you were telling me, Rusty, that everybody couldn't be further from their character that they play.
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that, how they're cast, I believe that, with Stephanie, I'm just going to brag about you right now. Stephanie is playing a very, very controlled human being in this. And usually she goes, you know, crazy and stuff from Mad TV, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend,
yeah,
a whole bunch of stuff.
That's
yeah.
where I knew you from, Stephanie, and Mad TV.
Right, right. Yes.
Yeah.
And this phone call.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, well, now we're good friends. Now we're all going to hang out when you come to Chicago. I'm going to buy you Illuminati's.
That's right. And now, yeah.
Take it, girl. Take
Go
it,
ahead,
girl.
Steph.
Oh, I was just going to say when it was an opportunity to play something very different, and I feel like Rusty and I are already siblings. We share a manager, and so it's like having, you know, that mother that you're vying for her attention. entertaining siblings, but we always see each other in auditions and would cross paths here and there and hear how the other was doing. And then, when this opportunity to actually work on something with Rusty came up, I was thrilled. It was great.
I'll pay you the $50 later, sweetie.
Yeah.
Ross.
Yeah.
$55 yeah. is what we settled on.
Okay. Oh, you have the best laugh. Stephanie, make her laugh, because when you say something, she starts laughing, and I can just listen to Rusty laugh all night.
Now I'm all self-conscious. Yeah.
Right. Sitting here in our winter coats and our scarves.
Yeah.
She, you know, in those Mad TV roles and stuff, she is much broader than, and she's sort of understated here, but there was sort of a certain edge that I felt like fit perfectly with some of the characters she's played with Esther, even though Esther is Rusty said, a more controlled character. So it was fun to see her play that side.
Well, Francis and all you guys, talk a little bit about the contrast of Chicago versus L.A., and the Chicago scenes, obviously, are probably in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
Oh, they
yeah.
sure are.
Yeah, let's talk about the contrast between the two.
That was intentional. Just having grown up in Chicago and then living in L.A. for most of my adult life, those are the two cities that I'm closest to. And once I started writing this, I guess it was the end of 2013, because it was the beginning of that winter that was called the polar vortex.
Oh yes,
good
times.
Right.
Yeah.
It was so intense. And I realized if I'm going to do this project that sort of showcases these two cities, I had to film it in the winter. So I hadn't finished the script yet, but I just went back to Chicago and basically shot the first act of the movie, which is the stuff that's there with the Chicago crew, kind of like a short film over just a few days. So the very first stuff we shot was after there was a big blizzard one day, and that morning I called up Rusty and said, let's just go out and film some of this. And a lot of that footage is some of my favorite stuff in the movie, just her walking around in the snow.
Is that where you filmed the scene where she's straddling the tow truck saying, don't repossess my car?
That's all part of the Chicago stuff. Yeah, yeah.
My favorite picture of the press kit, by the way.
Thank you.
You guys have to see this movie. And I have to ask you, Frances, specifically, because I love, sometimes they'll prepare a list of questions for us, and I haven't seen the movie yet, but I love this answer, so I'm just going to toss you a softball here. What aspect of the story changed the most for you?
Oh, well, I think you're referring to my wife getting pregnant.
Yes.
That she was playing a minor role. She was Esther's assistant, Stephanie Weir's assistant in the movie. And after I had filmed that stuff in Chicago, my idea was going to come back here, going to write the rest of the screenplay, and then, you know, raise the money and set it all up and be able to do it. And take the time we needed to film the L.A. stuff. And all that kind of got put into hyperdrive when I found out that we were going to have a baby.
Wow.
And I thought, well, there's no way we're going to be able to finish this movie now. But it occurred to me that it would actually be a strong choice to make her character pregnant instead. And that was sort of the impetus to say, I think we can do this. And we just sort of scrambled. She was 7 months pregnant when we filmed. So I just sort of wrote it and scraped it all together at the last minute there, at the end of, I guess it was 2015, and we filmed in January.
Okay, so the filming was about a year?
A little less.
A year and a half, okay.
It was about a year and a half between the Chicago filming, which was like about a weekend, and the L.A. filming, which was 12 days in January of 2016.
And also, on a sidebar on that,
yeah,
besides Stephanie Jane Markham, his wife, who plays Greta,
yeah.
Besides her getting pregnant, I also was going through the transition into wisdom.
Ah, yes,
I said to him, dude, I'm changing by the second. You're going to have to.
Once a week, she'd say, like, no.
She's
going to work if we wait much longer.
I was going to say, she's in the middle of the polar vortex, like, fanning herself, yeah, going, oh, my God, yeah, somebody bring in an air conditioner here.
Exactly.
No, it sounds like an awesome film and an awesome experience. And how can people see, you have a very special way that people in the Chicago area can see the film this weekend and next too.
Oh yeah, actually it's during the week, December 11th Tuesday.
That's
it's at
right.
The Music Box Theater.
Oh, one of my favorite
which
places.
Is my favorite theater ever.
Me too.
Growing up.
Yeah.
And and then it'll be playing at the Wilmette Theater for my homies.
Uh-huh.
That's December 12th and the 14th, and that's where I saw a lot of films growing up.
Another
so this is
great
just
venue.
Crazy town.
And I think most have like $4, $5 popcorn or like cheap popcorn too. So.
Oh yeah, they sure do. Yeah, and Music Box is just beautiful.
I love it.
It's one of my favorite theaters, and to be able to see it on that screen is so fun. And my sisters are going to be there.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really fun. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, it's been
Mention real quickly, because we talked about Stephanie Weir and why she was perfect for Esther, and obviously Rusty, who it's just amazing to see her carry a movie. I just want to mention Todd Stashwick's role.
He plays Todd's
boyfriend, this total meathead from Chicago who kind of gums up the works in the plot and the second act. He's hysterical.
He's got a nice really Chicago accent.
Somebody who could be both menacing and funny in equal measure, and that's Todd.
Todd, repeat after me. We're going to see if you pass the challenge, okay? Call your mom.
Call your mom.
See, I usually do the call your mom.
You know what? Call your mom.
Todd, your favorite
call
kind? You prefer a broad or a sausage?
I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
You know what? Francis, Stephanie, Todd, when you guys come back into town, we'll get together. We'll go to Lou Malnati's, and we'll break bread over a nice deep dish.
I'm in.
Awesome, you guys. All right, stay warm in L.A. Bye, Frances, Stephanie, and Todd.
Bye-bye.
I live for you, you guys. I live for you.
We love you guys.
Love you.
Bye, sweeties.
Bye.
They're awesome. Rusty, thank you so much for coming down, and I wish you and the whole cast and crew, and I hope Wild Honey is a huge success, which it sounds like it will be.
Thank you so much. It's really lovely to be here in this very fancy studio.
And please come back with your friends, and we're going to have to, you know, break bread over pizza with them.
There you go, Lou Malnati.
Lou Malnati. Go see Wild Honey, and again, you can see it at the Music Box and at the Wilmette Theater.
December 11th, and then December 12th and 14th at Wilmette Theater.
Get out and see it. Wild Honey. Thanks, Rusty.
Thank you.
More after this on WGN. 836 720 WGN. Thank you, David. We are just 20 minutes away from the Blackhawks playing the Anaheim Ducks. Chris Bowden will have your pregame, and of course, John and Troy on the call right here on 720 WGN. I am so excited to have in studio Dr. Bal Nundra. How you doing, Doctor?
Hello, Andrew. How are you? Good to see you again.
I'm doing great, and this is Wellness Wednesday, which we have on our show now at night with myself and Patty Vasquez. Patty is off tonight, but that means I get you all to myself.
Perfect.
Last time we spoke, you were talking about specifically the ketamine treatments that you've been giving out, and you brought a gentleman in studio who had been suffering from PTSD, and it made such an impact on me and I think so many of our listeners because you truly helped him change his life around. So let's talk a little bit about that specifically and ketamine treatments and what they can do for you.
Absolutely, Andrew. So ketamine is an anesthetic drug that was developed like 60 years ago, and it was about 2000, it was kind of accidentally discovered that it could be incredibly effective for treating depression, PTSD, anxiety, OCD, and just a variety of mental afflictions. And Jason is the gentleman who you were speaking with, who was actually a practicing clinical psychologist just a few blocks from here, and Jason had actually suffered from PTSD and depression almost his entire life since he was a child, and within just two treatments, he saw all of his symptoms lift after many years of struggling and experiencing so many different treatments and different medications and everything pretty much not helping him much at all. He'd become very treatment resistant, and just a couple of treatments, and he'd saw his symptoms lifting, and after the 6 treatments, he was completely asymptomatic. And that was about 6 months ago or so that we started treating him, 6 or 7 months ago.
Wow.
And just to give you an update on his progress, I actually just saw him earlier this week. He is still completely asymptomatic, has no symptoms.
Uh-huh.
He scores zeros on all of his depression scores and anxiety scores, and he only comes in once every 6 weeks or so for his maintenance treatment.
Okay,
and so he's just
amazing.
Really done phenomenal, and it's really changed his life. And as a result, he's changing a lot of his patients' lives. He's able to function better at work in his practice, and he's opening up other patients of his to the possibilities of ketamine, and it's really having a great impact.
It's amazing to me. Is it? I guess it's not as surprising to you, but how quickly these treatments take effect and how helpful they are so rapidly.
It's really amazing, and it actually always surprises me. I can't say that I ever get sick of seeing it, but it's when it happens, it always kind of blows me away because I'm always like, wow, how is this possible after all these years of suffering to after just a couple of treatments, a couple of days, sometimes after that very first treatment, patients have come recently back to us and saying, oh my God, I feel completely different after one treatment. So it's amazing.
What would you say to those who are perhaps maybe a little nervous about, you know, anytime someone has to take a medication or especially something of this sort, they might get a little nervous about starting a treatment or starting a medication. What would you say to them?
I would say talk to your psychiatrist about it. Talk to your therapist, your clinical psychologist. Talk to your providers about it first and you know, try to get a comfort level. And then you know, most psychiatrists and mental health professionals these days are fairly supportive of ketamine for certain cases. And a lot of them will completely support you, even regardless of the amount of experience they've had with it personally. They'll say, you know what, there's a lot of good science out there that supports ketamine. And you can definitely look into it. And then we can usually take it from that point onwards.
Now, right in the midst of the holiday season, the lights are up. It's red and green everywhere. We're right in the middle of Hanukkah right now, too. Supposed to be a time of joy and celebration. But for many people, as you know, Doctor, it's anything but the holiday season. And depression, feelings of anxiety just tend to heighten this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's called seasonal affective disorder or seasonal depression, and it's a very well-known phenomenon. It is recognized by the American Psychiatric Association as a true diagnosis. It happens typically in the fall and winter months, as you can imagine, and it basically is thought to result from the reduced hours of sunlight that mm-hmm. we experience that cause not only our mood changes just directly from the absence of sunlight, but sunlight. Reduced levels of sunlight have actually shown to decrease the levels of serotonin in our brains, and that's actually a neurotransmitter in our brain that can prevent or alleviate depression when it's in the correct levels. So it's also our circadian rhythms kind of get messed up, as you can imagine, with the light and day,
right.
And the length of the day is changing. That's also been implicated as a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And also melatonin, believe it or not, we tend to produce a little more melatonin in the winter times, and that can actually make you sleepier and all these kind of things. So there's a number of factors, as well as the social factors of stress, family situations and holidays and financial situations
sure.
that kind of creep up and
sure.
pressures that happen during the holidays.
Boy, we're talking to Dr. Balanandra. Tell us the website as well. It's very easy to get to this website.
Yeah, our website is very easy. It's www.ketaminechicago.com. That's KETAMINE Chicago.com. And our phone number is 844-948-6337.
And call and make an appointment. And you know what? Just talk. Just talk about it. Ask questions. You're open to questions.
I speak to almost all of our patients, do all the consultations myself. So I'm happy to pick up the phone and talk to anybody who calls us.
How actually does ketamine work? I know it's sort of it's maybe a chemical reaction, but what does it specifically do? What does it stop or what does it change to make you feel better?
So ketamine works in a few different ways, and one of the ways it works is it blocks a receptor in the brain called the NMDA receptor, and by blocking that receptor, that's kind of what was discovered, you know, about 10 years or so ago to be a pretty immediate relief of depression. It also causes release and activation of growth factors in your brain. So actually, over time, and the reason it works for such a long period of time after it's left your body is because it actually is kind of remapping and repairing your brain and kind of lighting up areas of your brain that were shut down and became kind of dormant and atrophic after all those years of stress on your brain from depression and anxiety.
And it could literally bring it back to life, so to speak?
Yes, imaging studies done at Harvard and other institutions have actually shown new nerve growth and nerve connections.
Wow. How about, I have to ask about headaches, because the last time that we spoke too, you know, I was saying I was getting these, not migraines, not to that extent, but to a point of where, you know, you have a couple Advils in the morning, a couple in the afternoon, and you start to rely on it, and you think, wait, you shouldn't be popping Advils like this.
Yeah, ketamine has definitely been shown to be pretty effective for treating migraine headaches specifically, and a large study just came out this past fall that showed it could be, you know, 60 or 70% effective against people who have not had headache relief or migraine relief from anything in the past, like refractory migraines. So again, it's if a patient has that, they're welcome to contact us, and I'll tell them more about our protocols and what we've done, and we've had a good amount of success with migraine headaches.
You absolutely have. The success stories just keep piling up, and we're so happy to have you a part of our Wellness Wednesday. Want to talk to you a little bit more about the specific treatments and how people can go about and take advantage of some of the services and treatments that you have to offer.
Perfect.
All right, stay with us, Dr. Balanandra. We'll be back after this on 720 WGN. 848 720 WGN. We continue our conversation with Dr. Balanandra. And, Doctor, we were talking a little bit more about a seasonal affective disorder, but let's talk a little about specifically treating seasonal affective disorder, what people actually have to do to go through the treatments, and how this really will help them, despite the fact that it gets dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or perhaps they're missing a loved one this holiday season.
Absolutely. Seasonal affective disorder affects everybody in different ways. People can have, obviously, depression that lasts all day. They can have problems with their sleep, fatigue, overeating, oversleeping, all these kind of things. So moodiness and, you know, anger. But it's diagnosed after you have like two consecutive seasons of really prominent symptoms during those winter months. That's the kind of the official diagnosis when you have symptoms of depression for two seasons in a row.
Yeah.
You have seasonal affective disorder. There are a number of therapies that you can do. First of all, light therapy. Light therapy is something that a lot of patients do, and it's been shown to be pretty effective for seasonal affective disorder based on the fact that There's reduced sunlight, and that involves getting a light box, which is like this special device with really bright light. It's like 20 times as bright as the brightness of a room.
Okay.
And patients will, you'll sit at that right when you wake up in the morning for like an hour or so.
So it's basically, it's in your room, it's in the room that you want.
And you put it on in the morning for an hour right when you wake up. And that little extra exposure to sunlight has actually been, or simulated sunlight has actually been shown to be pretty effective. Other things you can do, of course, is therapy. You can, it's great to get out and exercise, and especially if it's a bright sunny day, which we don't have too much of, but when you have one, you take advantage of it and you get out for a brisk walk, whatever you want to do. And then of course there's the antidepressant medications. The downside of that, however, is they might not even work until the season's over.
Right. So, and the side effects,
they can take two months, so sometimes up to 2 months or more to even work.
Sure.
And then you have the side effects of them in the meantime. And then they've only been shown, like the SSRIs have only been shown to be about 40% effective at the end of the day anyway. So it's kind of a, that's kind of a, what do we say, long run for a short slide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is quicker. You'll see results almost immediately.
Yeah, so with ketamine is another option, of course. And, you know, particularly this time of year, patients who already have major depression and already have bipolar disorder, they're specifically at higher risk for worsening symptoms and worsening depression during these months. And it's all these other factors that kind of throw in and make their depression worse.
Yeah.
So we typically do get quite busy at this time of year, and that's probably why. And basically, we have the patients come in, and they come in, a lot of our patients who are already have a history of depression, we've already been treated, they've already gone through their series, they typically are really careful about scheduling their maintenance infusions around the holidays to make sure they're covered.
Sure.
And it usually works phenomenally well to get them through the holidays.
I just love the fact that it's quick and it's effective, and it doesn't take months and months and months to work. You could see results so quickly, which it's very impressive to me.
Yeah. What is also amazing is that I've also found quite amazing about this is when you get into that maintenance phase, and even if you have a dip and you're feeling really down and your symptoms have kind of come back, it just takes one 45-minute ketamine infusion, and they're typically back to 100%. And that's pretty amazing, too. And that just goes to show you what ketamine is actually doing in your brain in the long term. It's really changing things up there for the positive.
Are there any side effects? I mean, anything that you should be worried about?
There really aren't. I mean, ketamine, the only side effects you really experience are while you're with us in the treatment room, and that's the dissociation. Ketamine, as you know, is a psychedelic, psychoactive drug. But some people believe, and some studies have shown now, that you actually want that dissociation to occur. It's actually important. It's an important part of the healing process.
And it's like a healthy separation almost.
It's like a healthy separation. You're out of your body. You're seeing beautiful things. And some patient just yesterday said he was just exploded into the clouds and was flying, and it was beautiful. And it really changes their mood almost immediately. And that is additive to what ketamine is doing with the neurotransmitters in your brain and what it's doing with the growth factor. So it's just another positive thing. Other than that, there's a small risk of nausea during the infusion or after the infusion, but we usually pre-treat patients. And typically,
people get that symptom from work, though, sometimes, so it's okay.
For a lot of things. and then you might be tired for an hour or so afterwards,
sure.
But then there's typically absolutely no side effects.
Very little. And you were telling me a little off the air, which I found this fascinating too, is that ketamine can be used to help those with concussions.
Absolutely. It's becoming pretty known that it's effective for treating specifically like migraines, again, that are related to concussions, as well as just people who do have like CTE type of symptoms, you know.
Oh, sure.
The football injuries and old athletic injuries that have affected their brain, and it's been shown to be pretty good in stabilizing their mood also. And we've actually had some really positive results with patients.
Is there a minimum and or a maximum age at which folks can start taking these ketamine treatments?
Ketamine has been shown by studies to be really safe in both the elderly patients as well as young patients in their adolescent and teen years. I have treated teenagers and young adolescents, and they've done absolutely great. In fact, young people actually tend to respond better and tend to last longer once they respond. And the reason we think why is because their brains are young and they're still kind of developing, and they're more, there's more neuroplasticity. Their brains are more able to change and adapt.
Yeah, and young people are so resilient.
Absolutely.
To any injury as well. It's, you know, I almost wish that ketamine treatments were more, I guess, affluent or more available back in the day, because so many athletes now experience concussions. And at the time, you know, many athletes have passed, including Dave Duerson, have passed away, and they wanted their brains to be, you know, studied for medical science. But if there had been ketamine treatments many years prior, or to the prevalence that they are now, we could have prevented perhaps even some of these deaths.
Yeah, it definitely would have probably would have had a great effect on the mood disturbances that have developed. And those patients had a lot of depression, obviously, and suicidality and the chronic migraines. Ketamine probably would have positively affected a lot of those things.
Well, I absolutely encourage everybody to give it a try, or at least call you with questions. And you're great. You're super easy to talk to. Phone calls, won't you?
Absolutely. Anytime.
And how can people find you again, Dr. Nedra?
www.ketaminechicago.com. That's KETAMINECHICAGO.com, or 844-944-6337.
Very good. Come back and visit us again, okay?
I'll be back soon.
We'll be back for Wellness
Happy
Wednesday.
Holidays.
Happy holidays. It's Dr. Bal Nedra again. It's KetamineChicago.com. More after this on 720 WGN.